Let's look at this story told in three scenes. The first scene is played out in verses 1 to 16 between the disciples and Jesus. Lazarus's sisters, Martha and Mary, send word to him, "Lord, the one you love is sick." No explicit request for help is apparently given. I think they want Jesus to discern the need and respond appropriately. They don't want to drag him away from other ministry. They're just hoping he'll come. Jesus gives his discernment in verse 4. This sickness will not end in death. This is prophetic. No, it is for God's glory so that God's Son may be glorified through it. So Jesus discerns God's hand in these circumstances. He knows that Lazarus is not in danger. And then something extraordinary happens. Jesus does nothing. Now that when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days. The message and the sickness cannot have been anything other than urgent. Martha especially has never struck me as someone who would scream for help over a headache. Jesus knows that it must be urgent, and yet he does nothing. That takes real courage and discernment. So often when we come up against a difficult situation in life or ministry, our first instinct is to spring into action, to invest energy and dynamism into seeking to find a solution, to do whatever we can to improve the circumstances, however marginally. Most of us, perhaps nearly all of us, can't rest content when we've got something urgent hanging over us. We want to do something, maybe anything, because doing something is better than doing nothing. Yet Jesus has the discernment and the stillness to discern when there is nothing to do. That takes real courage and trust. Someone he loves is suffering. Yet Jesus has discerned that at that moment, the right thing is to do nothing, to wait, to trust God until God has said, "Yes, you can go." It takes real courage to do nothing and to wait for the Lord to move when nothing is the right thing to do. The disciples think that Jesus' inactivity isn't discernment, but the outcome of mere calculation. They're assuming that he's not going because he's afraid of being lynched or stoned. Verse 8 suggests that they obviously think that such a prudential calculation is the right thing to do. "Rabbi, you know, a short while ago the Jews tried to stone you, and yet you're going back there." Coded message, "You've got to be bonkers, Lord. Last time we were there, they tried to kill you. Yes, we know Lazarus is sick and all that, and it's really, really sad. But surely Mary and Martha know just how important you are. They'll understand you simply can't go. You're just too important to risk." Jesus' response isn't clear on the face of it until we realize the day was assumed to have 12 hours. Although he knows that his time is coming fast, Jesus makes it clear that while there is time, they will not stumble about the Father's business. Willfully obtuse, the disciples assume that Jesus' play on words about Lazarus being asleep and going to wake him up means that, well, he's asleep, so he's going to get better. Imagine Jesus, I think, pausing for a moment and wondering just how he was given such an obtuse bunch of disciples before saying, "Lazarus is dead. Though it's terrible that he's dead, I'm glad you'll have the opportunity to see what God is going to do so that you might grow in faith." I really like Thomas. I really do. I love his honesty. But verse 16 is at the other end of the spectrum of whatever Winston Churchill's "we shall fight them on the beaches" is. It's as a rallying cry. It lacks a little bit, doesn't it? "Let us also go that we may die with him." Doesn't nerve the sinews and summon up the blood, doesn't it? I think it's a private meeting between the disciples. They've had a meeting on the side and they've only reluctantly agreed to go. So where are we at the end of our first scene? The disciples are terrified. They think Jesus is mad even for thinking about going back to a place where he nearly got stoned recently. And they're having to conquer their fear to go with him. Second scene is outside Bethany. When they arrive, they learn quickly that Lazarus has already been buried for 4 days. By that stage, decomposition has begun. There was a rabbinic belief that the soul hovered over the body for 3 days, hoping to re-enter the body, but that it departs when its appearance begins to change. Buried within 24 hours, Lazarus has been in the tomb for a further 4 days. He has started to decompose, with all that means for discoloration, for rot, and for stench. I guess they learn this from the many Jews who have visited from Jerusalem. When we were in Edgware, we lived opposite a very Orthodox Jewish neighbours. And the husband, who was a rabbi, died. And though he was buried within 24 hours, there then followed many days where the family was visited by literally hundreds of people from across the Jewish community. I think we must assume that this also was a prominent family, as were our neighbours, that friends and acquaintances, not just from their own village, but also from Jerusalem, have come to pay their respects. That's the background. Martha comes to meet Jesus. I don't think her words are a rebuke. She's simply stating her regret and her trust in Jesus. She's saying something like, "If only you'd been here, Lord, I know Lazarus would not be dead." Nor is she expecting a miracle. In verse 39, she makes it plain that she has no hope, such hope. She's stating her faith in Jesus, stating that she knows he's incredibly close to the Father. Jesus' words in verse 23 could be no more than the words a pious Jew would say to a grieving relative, the statement of a hope of a future resurrection. Certainly, that's the way that Martha receives them. We're in verse 23. Jesus goes further, not a promised future resurrection, but a statement that he is even there and then the resurrection and the life. That belief in him means that someone who has died can live again. Martha is able to confess and return her quiet confidence in Jesus. "Yes, Lord," verse 27, "I believe that you're the Christ, the Son of God, who was to come into the world." Then she goes to fetch Mary, her sister, and she tries to engineer a thing so that Mary can also have a private meeting with Jesus. But it doesn't work. The crowd who are following her see her get up and they follow her, supposing she's going to the tomb to mourn there, verse 31. I think Mary is more cheesed off with Jesus than Martha was. She's same statement, but with much more emotional force. I think she falls at his feet, and it's got a tone of disappointment and rebuke. "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." All this spoken in the context of Mary weeping at his feet, surrounded by a host of the Jews weeping also. Jewish burial customs dictated that even a poor family should hire at least 2 flute players and at least, I'm not kidding, 1 professional wailing woman. As we've already noted, this was quite a prominent family, so we can imagine there's quite a lot of professional mourning going on. Lots of flute players, lots of wailing women. And Jesus' reaction to real grief and to very professional grief is given in verse 34. Literally, he was outraged in spirit and troubled. In Greek, the word translated by the NIV as deeply moved is used for the snorting of horses. It suggests anger. It suggests indignation. But why is Jesus outraged? What makes him indignant? Can't be this particular death. He knows he's leapt ahead in this story. He knows he's about to meet Lazarus again. So it can't be outrage at this death. Why would that be grieving Jesus? I think what outrages Jesus is those things never intended by God to be part of the world. Sin and unbelief, grief and death. I think Jesus is outraged by the human condition shown by the scene in front of him. Outraged by the particular which provokes him to think of the universal. He's not outraged because Lazarus has died. He is outraged by the presence and the reality of sin and evil and death in the world. Throughout the rest of the passage, when Jesus is deeply moved, I think he's outraged that the barrier death represents before him. The Jews, professional mourners and otherwise, misread Jesus' outrage as grief for Lazarus. Some commend him for loving Lazarus. Others, 37, blame him for getting there late. They say, "It's all very well, mate, crying over spilt milk. But if you'd only got here in time, we'd have a party." Scene 3 is at the tomb. All the audiences, all of the dramatis personae come together at the tomb. Mary and Martha, the disciples, the crowds who are grieving, the professional mourners, everyone gathers together at the tomb. It's this cave with a stone laid across the entrance. Outraged at the presence and reality of death, misread by everyone as simple grief for a friend, Jesus astonishes them all. Take away the stone. Verse 39. I think it's one of those moments which crystallized just where you stood with Jesus. Was it one of those moments when the disciples were thinking, "You what? Why did we come? We didn't need to wait. We don't need to wait to get stoned. We're going to get lynched right here and now. Have you gone completely stark raving bonkers?" Martha, who's confessed to Jesus being the Messiah, clearly has no expectation that Jesus will do anything. She tells him straight, "Lord, he started to decompose. What possible purpose could be served by opening the tomb? Don't you know it's unhealthy to do this? Don't you know there'll be an absolutely rank stench? Don't you know that we'll all be ritually unclean when you do this?" That's what she's saying. And then Jesus says to her, "Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" Verse 40. So Martha consents and allows the stone to be rolled away. I think you have to see the reluctance in the people who roll the stone away. They are conscious that they are breaking every rule their culture had about purity and respect for the dead. I'm sure many in the audience are horrified. They are astonished at what they're seeing. They are ready to condemn Jesus utterly, even if they haven't already started. And yet they're also held by his authority. They're held to see what happens next. And still Jesus doesn't act straight away. With their nostrils presumably filling with a rank stench of decomposition, Jesus stands and addresses the Lord and his audience. "Father, I thank you that you have heard me." And they're all thinking, "Heard you about what?" I know that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you sent me. And they're all thinking, "Believe that God sent you? What are you doing? Can't you smell the stench? How on earth is this helping anyone? What about poor Martha and Mary? They're trying to get over it, and you brought them to smell the stench of their own brother's decomposing corpse. Just who do you think you are? Lazarus, come out." And they're all thinking, well, not very much, actually. Their brains have just fused. I think they're just thinking a whole row of exclamation marks and question marks. There's no coherent thought at all. "What did you just say?" An absolute silence. An absolute silence that drags into a long moment until they hear a faint shuffling. And as the noise gets louder, Lazarus, wrapped in bandages, limps into view, cloth round his face, hands and feet bound. Finally, the character we've been hearing about from the beginning actually makes it onto the stage. He's probably greeted with a few squeaks of terror and an awed silence. It's another whole row of exclamation marks and question marks. Because frankly, nobody there has any frame of reference for this at all. Nobody knows how to react. Nobody can marry up with what they're seeing with life as they have known it. It's a long, long moment of stunned silence until Jesus breaks the moment. "Take off the grave clothes and let him go." This is not a healing. It's much, much more than a healing. Jesus, outraged by the barrier of sin and death which had prompted him to become incarnate for us, shows that he has the authority and power to call someone back from death, to call someone through the barrier of death into new life. Jesus shows that he is the resurrection and the life. What does this mean for us today? Well, if you want to hear the rest of that, you'll have to come this evening when I've got more time. But first, it means we must ask God for a larger vision of who he is and what he can do. Although his disciples have seen Jesus do many miracles, still their vision doesn't stretch anything like as far as that of Jesus. From the beginning of the story, Jesus has a vision of how it will end. Not until his disciples see Lazarus walking Do they realize what this drama they're involved with was always about? We need to ask for a larger, truer vision of God. Not a safe God whom we can pat on the head. Not a safe God who's the divine equivalent of ibuprofen there to help us in our pain. But a wild God, an untamed God, a sovereign God who breaks the barriers we believe cannot be broken, who breaks the barriers that we simply cannot see beyond. You remember C.S. Lewis in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe? When the Pevensey children hear that Aslan is a lion, they say, is he a lion? Is he a tame lion? And Mr. Beaver laughs and says, of course not. Of course he's not a tame lion, but he's good. We need to ask for that wild, untamed God, what is it that you require of us? Where are we not seeing what your power can do? Where are we not walking truthfully and faithfully with you? Second, the removal of the grave clothes. Even after Lazarus has been raised, still the grave clothes need to be removed from him. If we take this as an image of salvation, of being summoned from darkness to light, even after we have been saved, we have to go through a process of having our old life taken away, of having the thoughts, the attitudes, the memories that have characterized a life in darkness removed by the power of the cross and by healing prayer. Salvation is just as conclusive as it is. Salvation is just the first step in a walk with God. It's only when we walk in the light that we see the darkness that shrouds us for what it is. Salvation needs to be followed by sanctification, by a growth in holiness and wholeness. It isn't enough, as with Lazarus, to come out of the tomb. We need to have the old, death-like, dark life taken away. Have you had the grave clothes removed? Have you had your fear of death removed? Have you had the one true life and light spoken into your hearts so that he abides there triumphantly? I know that this can be hard. Pain that we have got used to has at least the comfort of the familiar. It might have stopped hurting and just sunk to a dull ache. Contemplating seeking healing means contemplating bringing it all to the front of our minds. Means drudging it out of our memories all over again. Sometimes, frankly, we'd rather live with the grave clothes because confronting the pain just seems too hard. I understand and I respect that choice. Yet I need you to hear that it is a choice you're making, a choice to live with the grave clothes and not to allow Jesus to summon you to a new and fuller life. I am not at all saying that's easy. Just saying that Jesus' healing presence makes it possible. Might Jesus be calling you out of old pain into life in all its fullness? I will stop there.